So welcome to this last morning talk of the inaugural first retreat at Jhana Grove. And as you all know, just how fast time flies. Start a retreat and then it's over again. It's also to understand that once it's over, it's not all that long to the next retreat. So it's not that long between retreats, and some people have asked me that when they're on retreat, they can get some very nice deep meditation. How can they do that at home? And frankly, it's just very, very difficult to get such deep meditation at home, simply because you haven't got the supporting conditions. As I said, this is the reason why we build a retreat center like this, to try and get the best conditions to support the practice of deep meditation. Of course, when a person is very skilled at meditation, then they know how to meditate anywhere. But when we're first training, when we're first learning, we do need as many supporting conditions as possible. And it's just very difficult to find those at home. Nevertheless, some people do arrange their lifestyle, so it's very simple. And that they have some room or some place in their house or apartment which they set aside as a meditation room. And I always encourage people to have such a place. And even though that some people just have a small house or a small apartment, if you really are innovative, you can always find a space for your meditation. I did mention about that friend over in New York, the lawyer, and his meditation place is the cupboard in his office. One day he wanted to meditate, and every time he started meditating, his phone would go or a client would come in. He was actually a criminal lawyer. He could never really get any peace. And so together with his secretary, there was a cupboard in his office. There's always a cupboard somewhere. Had all sorts of junk in it, old papers and files. He just took them out, put them somewhere else. So he cleared out this tiny cupboard, put a cushion in there, and that became his meditation room. And his secretary locks him in there every lunchtime for half an hour. And she has the key, she won't let him out until he's finished his half an hour, because she says he's a much nicer boss in the afternoon once he's meditated for half an hour. It's innovative. And apparently she says that if any client calls or drops in, I'm sorry, he's in his cupboard. You know, sometimes you ring up people and they're at a meeting or they're out. It's a much more innovative to say, I'm sorry, he's in his cupboard, or I'm in my cupboard. So it's great they managed to do that. I know there have been some houses in Singapore, they have to have air raid shelters. And many people have actually turned those into a meditation room, because it's very soundproof, you can lock the door there, it's supposed to protect you from nuclear blasts. So sure, it's a nice place to put a meditation cushion in, a few icons or whatever, as your meditation room. The chances of using it for anything else are very slim. But even if you can't do that, just the corner of your bedroom. And disciples have done that. They set up a corner of their bedroom as their holy area, just for meditation. The most important thing if you do this is don't use that corner for anything else. Just keep it for meditation, exclusively. Because if you use it for something else, just like eating or just listening to cricket or sport on the radio or whatever, it spoils the whole atmosphere of the place. I know that in some traditions, where they sit meditation, that's where they also eat. And I always thought that that's not right. So it would be very easy in this place just to have this as a dining hall as well, so you can just wheel that food in and you could sit down and eat where you are. I mean, it would have the best buildings, but you find if you eat in the same place as you sit meditation, you find that it's not the same atmosphere. So when you have one particular place where you practice your meditation and no other place, it builds up energy. It builds up this momentum. And I've often noticed there are some places where it is very easy to meditate. It's got sort of the momentum of meditation behind it. So when you go and cross your legs and sit down there, you get swept along in that momentum of peace and silence and inward looking. I know now that after 25, 26 years almost of Bodhinyana Monastery, that place has got a huge amount of momentum of peace. And that Dharma Hall is a very silent, peaceful place, and people love meditating in it. Because we try and keep it to meditation, except for the one or two times of the year we have it a ceremony in there. We try and keep it for meditation, for nothing else. And if you keep your little corner in your bedroom, in your cupboard, or wherever, as your meditation area, it does pick up some momentum of peace. It may be even psychological, but I think it's more than psychological, because people have never experienced meditation before, have gone into that hall of Bodhinyana and have experienced some silence. I still recall an event which I mentioned in Opening the Door of Your Heart, when we were building a water tank, a concrete water tank which holds the main water supply of Bodhinyana Monastery. And the builder who was doing those tanks, a very tough guy, because it's amazing just how much concrete he had to wheelbarrow up ramps to get into the top of those tanks. Very tough guy, but very friendly. And at the end of the job, just when he was checking out of the monastery, he asked me, he said, "Brahm, would you mind if I look in your church?" He meant the meditation hall, that's what he called it. And I said, "Sure you can." And he had his working boots on, he had his work clothes spattered with cement, a really rough diamond. And he was talking and chatting all the way from the water tanks to the main hall. He wouldn't stop. And then he saw the sign, "You had to take your boots off," and he had so many laces on his boots, I had compassion on him, said, "Just put your head around the corner, you don't need to take your boots off." And as soon as he put his head, his body was in the foyer of the meditation hall, just his head went inside. It was one of those amazing experiences. He just fell silent. He stopped, he couldn't speak. And he was, "Oh, I need to be there for about 2 minutes, absolutely silent." Peace at that place really hit him quite strongly. And when he brought his head out of that peace again, he looked at me with a smile, you know, with a couple of teeth missing. And he said, "Wow, this is great, isn't it, Brahm?" It was one of those wonderful experiences where a non-Buddhist, just an ordinary Australian, hard-working guy, had actually changed in a second from being so talkative and so restless, and the peace had just got straight into him and shut him up. So if ever you've got a wife who talks too much, bring her over. A husband who bring him over, put his head inside the meditation hall, it might shut him up for a few seconds. But it is true that it has energy, it has momentum. And so if we do this, have these little places where we could set up a meditation corner, a meditation place, it does help us. It means every time we go there, it's easier to meditate. Every time we go there, our mind psychologically remembers this is meditation time. It's not where I work, it's not where I eat, it's not where I sleep, it's not where I entertain myself. This is my meditation corner. And by doing that, you're actually allowing the meditation practice to continue when you go home. It won't go as deep as you have in a meditation, a retreat center, where everything is supporting you, where you can meditate for a long time, where you can rest when you need to rest, when you can walk when you need to walk. In a retreat center, the reason why we have these is because it's designed especially for meditation. And of course, this is a retreat center which has been built from scratch to be a Buddhist meditation retreat center. Many other places we have used, they have been designed for conferences, they're designed for seminars. You find our retreat, the retreat center in North Perth has pianos in it. So it's just the whole atmosphere is actually not set up specifically for Buddhist meditation. But this place has been. So it's very hard, I would imagine, to find a place as conducive as this to the practice of deep Buddhist meditation. But you can do something in your house, in your home. And you can ask your kids or your partner, "This is my meditation time, can you please keep it quiet?" And they can usually do that. And if they won't do that, you can grab your meditation time. And a couple of stories. There was one prisoner I used to teaching meditation to, and he sort of complained one day to me, because he said he would meditate early in the morning before the first muster, the roll call of all the prisoners, in his cell. And the prison guard would actually check up on everybody every hour by opening the grill on the window. It was a tough jail, so You know, he has a metal door with a little window on, with bars on the window. And he said the guard would notice he was meditating early in the morning. And for no reason other than just to stop this guy being peaceful, he would shine the flashlight right in the guy's eye and make as much noise with the flashlight on the bars as possible to disturb him from his meditation. And he would keep doing that until this prisoner would open his eyes from his meditation. And then the prison officer would walk away. You're just disturbing this meditator for no good reason except, now I'm the prison guard, you're the prisoner, you deserve to suffer. And so he came to complain. He said, look, I'm trying to meditate, I'm trying to make some peace in my mind, and these prison officers, they just won't let me. He said, I can't complain to anybody because I'm just an ordinary prisoner. But you know, you're a visitor here. You know, you're teaching me meditation. If you say something to the superintendent, maybe that prison officer will stop. And of course, I never needed to do that. I said, no, this is something much better than me telling the prison superintendent to stop this guy disturbing in the morning. I said, you carry on sitting. No matter how much noise, never open your eyes. Don't move. Don't allow that prisoner officer to disturb you physically. And if he shines a light in your eyes, just don't open your eyes. Sit there motionless and see what happens. And the prisoner had enough confidence in my teachings. He did that. And a couple of weeks later, he came and told me, the prison officer never does that anymore. Because the prison officer had done that, made a noise, shined the torch into his eyes, and the prisoner never reacted. Because the prisoner never reacted, the prison officer gave up. What's the point of making all this noise? It doesn't do anything. He still sits there like a zombie, so he left. He said, this is how you win your meditation time and how you win your space. If people do try to disturb you, you stand your ground, you sit there and don't do anything. The classic tale, there was one of the students from the Armadale meditation group, this young woman with young children. She told me that, you know, she loved meditating, and it's very stressful being up to young kids. She'd like to do a bit of meditation sometimes, but she said every time she sat down to meditate, her kids would be in her ear screaming, Mummy, 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 I want a glass of water. Mummy, 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 Mummy. They would never let her alone. And so she said one day she had enough. So she just sat down on a meditation cushion. She had about a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. Mummy, 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 I want some orange juice. And she didn't move. She just carried on meditating. Mummy, Mummy, as they started pulling her hair. Mummy, Mummy, Johnny wants to go to poo. Just sat there. And then they started getting desperate. They started really pulling her hair. Mummy, Mummy, Mummy. And she didn't move. And then they got very innovative. Never underestimate the psychological intelligence of 5- and 7-year-olds. Mummy, Mummy, Mummy. David has got a knife out of the kitchen drawer. Mummy, 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 Susan has turned the gas on. I tell you, that's what she told me they said. They said that someone's got one of the kitchen knives out and the old kid has turned the gas on. And she was a great meditator. She just sat there. Okay, calm yourself up, blow up the house, I don't care, I'm meditating. And she just sat there. And of course, after a while, the kids stopped pulling her hair and making threats. And she had a half an hour meditation, and when she came out afterwards, the kids were sitting quietly in the corner playing. They hadn't destroyed the house, they hadn't carved each other up. That was just a threat to children wanting attention. And because she just sat there and not moved, not been disturbed, she won her meditation half an hour. So she could meditate any time she wanted to. When she sat down and started meditating, the kids realized, Mummy is meditating no matter what we do. We can't get her out. So they just left, and they were quite happy by themselves. And actually, just interesting, when she said she was meditating quietly, and when she came out, the kids were playing quietly. There's something which she didn't notice, which I know, if you are quiet, you bring quietness and peace to the others in the house. If you're agitated, you make your kids agitated as well. So by her being peaceful and quiet, she was actually calming her kids down as well, even though she was actually doing nothing. You're sitting there. So you can win your meditation time just by sitting there. And if your husband comes along and says, darling, 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 you know, I need a cup of tea. Darling, 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 there's somebody on the telephone for you. just forget it. Don't even listen. Just carry on meditating. Then you win your half an hour's meditation or 1 hour's meditation. And after a while, just your husband, your partner will just give up. We're just meditating. No one can disturb him. And so they will protect you. And they also value the fact that you meditate at home because it does make you more peaceful, more kind, and more gentle. Several times people have come to the meditation classes, especially, I don't know why, it's women who've come and told me this story, that they never wanted to come to the meditation that evening. They were tired, had a busy day at work, and they just wanted to hang out in front of the TV, have a cup of coffee, and they didn't want to meditate and go out to our meditation class. But their kids told them, "Mummy, are you going to meditation this evening?" "No, darling, I'm too tired." "Mummy, why didn't you go to meditation?" "No, I just want to stay at home." "Mummy, you must go to meditation this evening." And they were sent by their kids to go and meditate. And then the women would laugh and say, "I asked my kids, why should I go to meditation?" "Because you're a much nicer mummy when you come home from meditation." The kids noticed it. I mean, the kids are just so honest. They don't play games. They're not what you call corrupted enough to sort of lie like that. They realize that mummy, daddy are much nicer, more beautiful people once they've meditated. So you can gain that space in your house to keep on your meditation practice. And don't think, "Oh, well, once I've got everything out of the way, then I'll meditate." Because there's too many things to get out of the way in a house or in a business. You never get all your letters written, or your emails replied to, all of your housework done, all of the chores in the house done. But look, you're never going to get them done anyway. You're going to die with so much unfinished business, each one of us is. So instead of getting all that unfinished business out of the way, get enlightenment out of the way first of all. Get that out of the way. Make that the highest priority. Get enlightened first, and then you can wash the dishes. It's just priorities. If you give priority to your meditation practice, it's very easy to find the time for it. If you're a Sri Lankan, you love cricket. If you're from Penang or Singapore, you love soccer. In Australia, you might like AFL. But whatever the sport you like, if it's an important match, you will always find time to watch it and see it. Even if it's World Cup soccer in the middle of the night, people will stay up and watch it. So why can't you meditate late at night? What's more important, the soccer match or the enlightenment match? Which is more important? So if you really want to, you can always find time to meditate. So try and find that time, set aside time and make it more important than anything else. Because it's that investment of time in quietening the mind, in making it peaceful and making it still. It not only gives you this great spiritual depth to your life, it gives you the peace of mind which creates good health for you. It's much more efficient to spend lots of time meditating, and then you save time having to go and see the doctor or spend time in hospital when you start to get sick. You meditate instead. You waste less time. I don't know how many hours and days people waste by being sick. Going to hospitals, waiting in the rooms, having tests. I want you to have one test, then you have another test, and then you have another test. These doctors are always doing tests. It takes such a lot of time out of your day. So if you meditate, you're actually saving a lot of time by giving yourself half an hour to meditate. You're spending a lot of time with all these problems and difficulties which you face in life, which all came about because, you know, you weren't mindful enough. You said the wrong thing, or you made mistakes in life because you weren't mindful. The reason why you weren't mindful, your stillness in meditation wasn't strong enough. It didn't empower the mindfulness to be strong and bright and clear. So you made too many mistakes. What I'm saying is that if you meditate, you save time. It's an investment in time. So if you're doing nothing, you've got lots of time, then you don't need to meditate. But if you're very busy, then you really need to meditate. To save time. To be more efficient in the way you use your brain. To be more sharp in what you do. More mindful. More healthy. It's an investment in time. So I never think, oh, I can't find half an hour, I'm too busy. That's a person who doesn't understand what meditation is. If you really are busy, then I have to do something. That's the famous saying of Thich Nhat Hanh. There's not much time, therefore I must go slowly. Instead of there's not much time, therefore I must go fast, that's what most people think. Not much time, therefore I must go slowly. What it means is I can't afford to make mistakes, so I have to go carefully when there's not much time. And the best way to go carefully is to make peace, be kind, be caring, and be gentle. So that's why we meditate. And when we develop those attitudes in our meditation, they do carry over into our daily life. We do become more aware of what we're doing, and much more aware than what we're doing, what we're thinking. We become aware of our inner world. And how much we create this terrible ill will and anger in our mind when we don't really need to do this. Instead of actually fighting other people when they're really stupid and give us a hard time, we can make peace with them. We don't have to get our own back. We don't have to seek revenge. One of my favorite sayings is, as a Buddhist, you don't need to seek revenge at all, because karma will get the bastards anyway. And I say it like that so people could remember it. Because karma's going to get them, so you don't need to worry about them. If they've been messing around, giving you a hard time, acting selfishly, cruelly and meanly, well, karma's going to get them. So you can just let karma do that. You don't have to do anything. You're free. You can be at peace. So that when we understand the way of our mind, we don't need to sort of get involved in ill will and all the cravings in life. We're learning in meditation that if you really want to have peace and freedom, then you just let go. You don't go chasing the durian like the stupid donkey. The durian comes to you. And much of life is like that. We go chasing things so much, and then after the end of our life, what have we done? All this chasing, all this striving, all this accumulating of wealth and possessions and fame and family. So what? And the big so what? What is really important in life? And hopefully in retreats like this, you have these moments of great importance. Experience and say, wow, this is really important. This is what life is all about. Not the accumulation of wealth or possessions or family. Not the winning of the World Cup and the euphoria which only lasts for an hour or two. But this deep sense of peace, contentment, fulfillment which comes in the deep meditations. Sometimes people ask you as a monk, what is the meaning of life? And they think it's an explanation, or it's a sutta, or it's just a paragraph of words. You don't find the meaning of life in words and descriptions, you find the meaning of life in the stillness of the mind. That's why this is not just to be happy and to be have a good time in meditation. This is where your insights arise from in meditation. The insights, the wisdom of the Buddha only arises in the still mind. And it's for that reason, as I mentioned earlier on this retreat, when I'm asked to go to a school or a school comes to visit the monastery, and they ask me just a common question, because it's a question they have to ask people of other religions. What is your holy book, Ajahn Brahm? We Christians have the Bible, the Muslims have the Quran. What's your holy book? And I've told them for a long time now, the holy book of Buddhism is not the Tripitaka, it's not the suttas. The holy book of Buddhism is meditation, the stillness of the mind, because that's where all the insights and wisdom come from. So that's a very profound thing to say. Now, all the teachings of the Buddha are to be found within your body and mind. Actually, the Buddha said that. When this monk, this was the story of the first monkonaut, not astronaut or cosmonaut, Rohitasa, who learned how to levitate. And he could levitate so well, it wasn't just flying through the air, he could fly out into space. So he always wanted to know, where does this universe end? Where do the four elements, earth, air, fire and water, which make up this universe, cease without remainder? So he was the first spaceman or space monk If we're out of this atmosphere looking for the end of the universe. And it's a fascinating story because obviously this guy was knowing something. He said, he flew so far to where the light of the sun and moon shine not, to the dark spaces between the world systems. That's outer space. It's wonderful that he could actually describe it. It's where the light of the sun and moon do not shine. And not unexpectedly, he died on the way. And he never found the end of the universe, so he was reborn. And when he was reborn, he remembered that experience, and he went to go and ask. First of all, he asked these devas. He asked the first level of devas. Yeah, you know, I've travelled all around the place trying to find the end of the universe, where earth, air, fire and water cease without remainder. I couldn't find it. So I ask you, you're heavenly beings. This was the realm of the four great kings, the lowest heavenly realm. And the realm of the four great kings said, we don't know where the universe ends, but why don't you go, there's another level of devas above us. They're the Tara Tings of devas. You go and ask them, because they're really smart. So when you ask the Tara Tings of devas, so we don't know, but there's other devas above us, the Tusita devas. So they passed the buck to the Tusita devas, the Tusita devas passed the buck to the Yama devas, the Yama devas passed the buck to the Nimanarati devas, the Nimanarati to Parinimita Watawati devas, and last of all they sent them up to the Brahma, to the god. They said, surely God will know. So he went up to the Brahma realm, and they asked, they call it the woes in the assembly of Brahma, and his monk said, I want to find out where the universe ends, where earth, air, fire and water cease without remainder. And they said, we don't know, but Brahma the God, I'm sure he will know. Where is he? We don't know where he is, they said. But every now and again this light appears in our realm, and then the Brahma comes out of that light. And then sometimes the light appears and then he disappears into that light. What's that called? Nimitta, because Brahma sometimes hangs out in first jhana and sometimes comes back into the world. This is Nimitta stuff. And a short time later, the light appeared and Brahma came out and said, what do you want? And he said, I've been asking all these devas, now, where does earth, air, fire and water cease without remainder? When does the universe finish? And they always say they don't know, and they said to ask you. And then Brahma said, I am God, the firstborn, the creator, the maker, the chief of all that has been and all that will be, the firstborn, the almighty, the omniscient. That's not why I asked you, said the monk. I asked you, where does fire and water cease without remainder? Where does the universe finish? And Brahma said, I am God, the firstborn, the creator, the omniscient. Look, be that as it may, but I ask you, where does earth, air, fire and water cease without remainder? It happened three times, and after the third time, Brahma took the monk by the arm and pulled him away. He said, shh, don't tell anybody, but I don't know. I don't want these other people to know that God doesn't know. I'm supposed to be omniscient. And anyway, you're a stupid monk, said Brahma. He said, look, go and ask the Buddha. Now he will know. So you've come to the wrong place. You've gone to see the Buddha straight away. You wasted my time and everyone else's time. So the monk went down to see the Buddha. And the Buddha said, monk, the four elements cease without remainder. The universe ends. And you know the beginning of the end of the universe inside this fathom-long body and mind. Inside, that's where you see the beginning and the end of the universe. Now it's a famous teaching of the Buddha. The beginnings and the end of the universe are to be found within you, not in outer space. And this is the Dhamma. The Dhamma is to be found inside, not in the Tripitaka, not in the Heart Sutta, the Lotus Sutta, or any other sutra. It's found inside. That's why meditation is the holy book of Buddhism. So that's why not the monk, I'm not the authority, Ajahn Chah is not the expert. You are the expert. So we meditate to make our minds really still, understanding that in that stillness, then we'll understand the Dhamma, and then we'll see things as they truly are. Because that's exactly what the Buddha said, and all the holy monks and nuns have said that for 2,500 years. It's in the stillness of the mind you see things as they really are. Or, as the Buddha said it in Pali, samadhipatthaya yatha bhuta jnana dasana. From samadhi, from the still mind, you see things as they truly are. Yatha bhuta, as they truly are. Dasana, you see them. All insight comes from the still mind. Not from thinking, not even from listening, but from seeing in a place of stillness. So this path of meditation, again, is not just to have a bit of peace in your mind and let go of the stress of your life. As you meditate more and more, you become more understanding of what the Buddha really taught. And sometimes people say, do I have to do this? Do I have to do insight? You don't do insight, you don't do samatha. It's a natural unfolding. It happens in spite of you. Just the same as if you're going back this afternoon, going back to Melbourne, to Canberra, to Sydney, going back to KL, to Penang, Terengganu, Thailand, all these other places you're going back to, and Singapore. And when you go back, you get on those airlines. And as soon as you sit down, you don't have to do anything anymore. Meditation is like that. It's on Buddha air, as I like to call it. You've already checked in, you've got your boarding pass. Just you get on Buddha air, you sit on your appointed seat, you strap yourself in. The pilot takes off, and from that point on, you have to do nothing else. And as you sit on Buddha air, it doesn't matter just how quick you want that aircraft to go. You may be in a hurry to get home, but if you're in a hurry to get home, or you want to linger up in the air for a little bit longer, it doesn't matter. The aircraft goes according to its schedule, not yours. The wonderful thing about Buddha Airlines is you're sitting in your seat, and that's where you enjoy not the in-flight service. You don't have movies on there. You enjoy the insight service. Because insights come to you. It is the flight attendants come up to you and say, we have on offer this morning the insight into dependent origination. And they just give it to you. Say, oh wow, that's what it means. I always wonder what that meant. You've got insight into Satipatthana. Well, these monks have taught about this, but now you actually get it. I understand it now. Thank you so much. And sometimes on some of those flights they have special offers. They bring you a big plate of sowan, a stream inning. Do you want stream inning today? And they just offer it to you and say, thank you very much. Do you anything else? Yes. For seconds after you get stream inning, the next course on the menu is once returning. Yeah, thank you very much. And the main course, of course, non-returning. Oh, that's really delicious. And a special sweet dessert, full enlightenment. And it's all served up to you. You don't have to go and cook it yourself. You don't have to go and fetch it. You just sit in the seat and it's put on your tray. Now that's exactly what insight actually is. You just sit there absolutely still and it comes to you. Now what would happen if you're on Buddha Air or like Thai Airways, Singapore Airlines and Qantas and you went to argue with a flight attendant like a certain Prime Minister did recently? That's our Kevin Rudd. He got into trouble because he was arguing with a flight attendant. It was actually must have been the RAF flight. He wanted vegetarian food and had meat food or something. And he got very upset. Now, if you do that, you get thrown off the plane. You're not allowed to fly anymore on Buddha Air if you start arguing with a flight attendant. Or if you go up to the kitchen or the galley and ask, I want my so one now. Give me my insight now. And say, please madam, please wait, it'll be served in a few moments. No, I want it now. And again, they forbid you from flying Buddha Air again. So your job is just to sit in your seat and shut up. All these wonderful insights, they're coming. Just wait for them. They often say, the check is in the mail. If it hasn't come yet, actually it has come many times, but you've just been too sleepy to be there to receive the check when the postman has called. Or you've just too busy thinking about something else, and Now the enlightenment postman has come. The enlightenment says, anyone there? Oh, it looks like he's thinking about home or thinking about the soccer or something. So he goes somewhere else and gives your check to another meditator. So you've got to be aware and there at the time, and then you can receive the check, because you're making good karma, you're making all this good work, it has to happen. So this is actually when we meditate. Sometimes it's strange, but sometimes you'll be meditating here and nothing much has been happening. But then when you're on the aircraft or when you're at home, a few days later you get these amazing insights or incredible deep meditations. And it's caused by this retreat. It's just that sometimes it takes a time for the causes to work their way through, you know, your complicated mind. So don't be surprised if a few days after this retreat you get a visit from the postman. And it happens quite often, it's really quite sweet. So this is what happens. So you're going home soon, so carry on meditating as much as you can. Keep those attitudes of meditation, of making peace, being kind, being gentle. And if you can do that in your daily life as well, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Any problem which you cannot solve, make peace, be kind, be gentle. You may not be able to do anything, but you can at least always make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's something which you can always do at every moment in your life. Even if you're sick and you're dying in great pain and distress, you can always make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's something you can always do. And the reason is because it's not doing anything at all, it's just letting things be. And if you follow that path, you become a more peaceful person, kinder person, a more gentle person. The sort of person the postman is liable to want to meet and give the enlightenment check to. The postman who worked for Buddha Post will never go and, you know, give a check for enlightenment to an angry person or a selfish person or an irritable person, because you don't deserve that check. But if you're a peaceful person, a kind and gentle person, then the postman likes to visit you and maybe give you an extra check, a few psychic powers, just as a special offer, just on the inaugural retreat. But sometimes this happens, and so when this happens, remember why it happens, and this is actually how one can carry on that that meditation practice back at home as best you possibly can. Again, you can't get as deep in meditation as you do on meditation retreats. At least you can do something. There was a story which was in Jack Kornfield's book, Living Buddhist Masters, a long, long time ago. There was a Burmese monk who was an arahat, fully enlightened. And he had a strange story, because he'd gone to a monastery as an ordinary farmer with a wife and with kids. Heard a great teaching of the Dhamma, got so inspired he wanted to become a monk. He wanted to become a monk, meditate and become enlightened. But he had a family to look after. So he realized that it would be totally irresponsible to leave his family and just go and become a monk. So he set up a plan. He would work really hard, spend very little, educate his children, make sure that they had grown up and got married, and made sure he'd left enough money for his wife, and then he would become a monk. So it took about 20 years of hard work, saving up, spending nothing on himself, making sure his kids were okay, until he had enough money that his wife would be supported for the rest of her days. Now, only very simply, he's only a farmer. And then he asked to go off and become a monk. So he became a monk, and with a few months he became fully enlightened. And the other monks were so surprised. How come he did this so fast? And in a few months after his ordination, he became an arahant. They checked him out, and it was the Dinky Dai arahant. And they asked him, he said, how did this happen? And then they found out in those 20 years when he was preparing for ordination, when he was ploughing the fields, he wouldn't be listening to the radio or wasting time. He would be just being aware and mindful of the feeling of the plough on his hands. He would be focusing on where that plough was going in the soil. He'll be fully mindful, aware, focused on the task at hand. So having practiced like that for 20 years in his daily life, focusing on the task at hand, being as mindful as he possibly could, making peace, being kind and gentle as much as he could, he'd done so much groundwork in those 20 years that when it came time for him to leave the world and become a monk, his momentum of letting go was so strong it only took him a few months to be totally enlightened. And I love that story because it shows us the power of practice in the lay world. You can do a lot in your life to be kinder, to be more peaceful, to be more gentle, and to not to waste the stillness of your mind by getting upset at things which you can't change, arguing at people where your argument is just going to ruin your reputation and not going to change because how hard you shout. So don't waste that stillness. Preserve it. Be mindful, be kind, be gentle as much as you possibly can in your life, and put the focus on one thing at a time, whatever you're doing. Learn how to focus on the letter you have to write, or on the telephone call which you're taking right now, or the SMS which you are sending. One thing at a time, focus on that. And if you can learn how to focus on one thing at a time, being peaceful, being kind, not being angry at things you can't change, then of course when there's opportunity to come on a meditation retreat, you're prepared. The mind knows how to focus on one thing, whether it's metta, whether it's on the breath, whether it's on the legs when you're doing walking meditation, knows how to do that because that's how you've been practicing at home. And it knows how to be kind, it knows how to be gentle, it knows how to not get angry when someone slams the door or starts snoring or whatever. I don't know how much time has been wasted on this retreat when people have got upset and angry at each other. You're wasting your own time. So when we practice like this at home, we find that when there is an opportunity to go on a meditation retreat, wow, the pot has been warmed up, so it's just a small time to bring it to the boil, and then you get these beautiful deep meditations. So don't think that you have to wait till the next retreat before you can really get still. You can do a lot of work at home by learning just how to find a place to meditate, how to focus on one thing at a time, how to be mindful, careful, kind with whatever you do. And that way you'll find that when the next retreat comes, you don't have to waste so much time getting back to where you were before. Little time and then you're right back, and then you can take your meditation deeper and further. And when you take your meditation deeper and further, then you can get these attainments which many people aspire for, things like stream winning. You often remarked in the time of the Buddha, there's all these people attaining to being stream winners and once returners and non-returners, and all these monks and nuns being arahats. And sometimes people ask the question, how come this doesn't happen these days? Is it because that people have changed? That we are more stupid than in the time of the Buddha? And it's quite clear to me that's not the case. Things have not changed much at all since the time of the Buddha. And if you want to sort of prove that for yourself, and you want some interesting reading, have a look at some of the Tripitaka, but not the suttas, not the Abhidharma. Look in the Vinaya. If you want some entertainment, look in the stories which led up to the Buddha laying down these rules. Because the stories are a window into ordinary life in the time of the Buddha 25 centuries ago. It's actually a mine of anthropological information which no one has really used. Because these stories are ordinary people. If you read the suttas, these are the whiz kids, or the whiz monks, the whiz nuns, the whiz lay people who did these amazing things and became enlightened. But what about the ordinary people? The ordinary people who made mistakes, that's in the Vinaya, because once they made a mistake, then the Buddha laid a rule about it. And my favorite story there, to show you that people have not changed since the time of the Buddha till today, was a story of the nuns cleaning out their toilets one morning. And the nuns' monastery in the time of the Buddha would be actually in the city, because people were afraid the nuns would get violated and raped and beaten if they were just staying in the forest, unprotected. So there was a monastery in the city, just on the edge, it's a quiet place. And in the morning, the nun who had the job of emptying the night soil, was basically the bucket of shit, because there was no sewage in those days. It would go down these little troughs into a bucket, and she had the job to empty that in the morning. And instead of emptying in the proper place, she decided to throw it over the monastery wall. Now, it's very early in the morning, So, you know, the chances are there'd be no one on the other side. But that morning there was. And the person on the other side, you can read it for yourself, this is almost verbatim. The person on the other side of the wall was actually a rich merchant who had an appointment with the king that day. Now, when you have an appointment with the king, you know, you don't wear sort of, you know, the jeans and t-shirt. You know, you wear your best clothes. So he had his best clothes on him, you know, hair all nicely slicked down, you know. And he was walking past on the way to the palace, this bucket of shit fell on his head. Literally. Now, if that happened to you, you wouldn't be all that amused, would you? In fact, you'd be very upset. In fact, you'd be irate, which he was, because he knew where it came from. He knew on the other side of the wall was a nunnery. And he was so livid. These not, how could they do this to me? These are supposed to be spiritual people. And they just thrown a bucket of poo on top of my head. And he said, these aren't real nuns. He said, they're just prostitutes. That's all they are, just prostitutes dressed up as nuns. He was so upset at them. Now, those days, the monasteries were built out of wood. So he got a firebrand, a torch. And he went into that monastery. He's going to burn that monastery down. That's how angry he was. Burn the whole place down. They can't do this to me. On the way to see the king, look what they did to me. You can understand he was upset and angry. Like you would probably be upset and angry if that happened to you. I know the toilets in this place aren't working properly, but we don't go to that degree. So he went in there, but at the monastery gate, for protection, had a gate man, like a caretaker. And he saw this guy in there just livid and stinking with a firebrand with a torch. He said, where are you going? He said, look what these prostitutes have done to me. Don't call them nuns, they're not nuns, they're prostitutes. Look what they've done to me. I'm going to show them what. I'm going to burn the whole monastery down. See if I don't. And at that point, the caretaker said, you mean that bucket of shit came from nuns? Yeah, look at it. Wow, he said. That really is lucky. That's auspicious. To get doused with this holy stuff from holy nuns. Wow, you are really, really lucky. And he said, really? It's auspicious. Now, if you don't believe that, I remember this general, I think he was Upon Ek, which is the major general, came to see Ajahn Chah one day with all his medals. Now, this was a time, I think, military dictatorships in Thailand. These were very powerful people. And he went up to Ajahn Chah to ask for some holy water. And Ajahn Chah never had a bowl of holy water. He said, come over here. Bend down your head. And he bent his head and he spat on his head. And he rubbed the saliva in. And I thought, Ajahn Chah, you've gone too far. You can't spit on a general, not in Thailand, and rub it in his hair. He did that. I saw it in my own eyes. And this general said, oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'm the only general in Thailand that's got such holy water, such personal holy water. He got away with it. So people haven't changed. If you've got a bowl of shit from Ajahn Chah, you say, oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So this gatekeeper sort of taught this guy not to burn out, talked him out of burning down the monastery. He said, this is really auspicious. This is really lucky. Look, go back home, get washed and changed. It won't take that long. Something really lucky is going to happen to you today. I guarantee it. And so he believed in that. And so he went down, got changed and scrubbed up, put on some new clothes, went to see the king. It was a bit late, but the king awarded him this very expensive contract. And he went around and said, wow, it's so lucky, you know, to be blessed with holy shit from the nuns. Because look what's happened to me. I've made us a lot of money today because I got this contract. And he went around sort of saying that to all the people. I don't know if the people were queuing up to get there, so we made so much money. But he got back to the Buddha, and the Buddha called all the nuns together. And he laid down a rule. It's one of the Paticca rules for the nuns. You shall not throw buckets of shit over the monastery wall. It is, it's one of their rules. Look at it. And he said, you were really lucky that time, nuns. But don't try it again. It's only because of that smart talking caretaker that Graswell, he got you out of trouble, but don't count on it again. And that's a story from the time of the Buddha. And you can relate to it. People haven't changed at all since that time. That's right, yeah, we can try. No, it's only a rule for the nuns, because the nuns did it, and they lay down the rule. If it happens, if it doesn't happen, you don't need a rule for it. They never sort of laid it down. But it is one of the rules, especially for the nuns. So please remember that. Just, But the reason I tell that story, it's a bit of entertainment, but it's also to show that people haven't changed. They're just as silly as they are. No, 2,500 years ago. There may have been Indian, there may have been such many centuries ago, but people's nature has not changed at all. So why is it that people can't get enlightened these days? Well, they did 2,500 years ago. The reason is you can get enlightened. It's there for you. You just have to follow the instructions. And there's the instruction manual. How many of you have ever got sort of a new appliance? And you plugged it in and it's gone bang. And then you read the instructions. But read the instructions first, and then you use the thing instead of playing around with it. And only when it goes wrong do you read the instructions. So it's the same with meditation. You have the instructions. Read them. Understand them. And when you understand them, then you meditate, and then it works. People do get peaceful. They do get jhanas. And once they've got those jhanas, they're off. Unforgettable experiences. And I say they're pregnant with insight. You go back to them, you find all the reasons why the Buddha talked about anatta, non-self, what he meant about the nature of the will, the nature of consciousness, the nature of this body, life and death, happiness and suffering. It's all there for you when you've experienced these amazing states of stillness, where many things have disappeared. And the biggest happiness you've ever had, and you say, why? Why is this such a great bliss? And it's always because what's missing was just a bundle of suffering. And that's one of the reasons I keep telling you, if you do get those jhanas, you will get those jhanas when you get those jhanas. Yeah, you'll contemplate what's there, but always look at what was missing. What wasn't there in that experience? And you'll find, because it wasn't there, because it disappeared, that's why it was bliss. What would disappear was a bundle of dukkha. You understand, the way to overcome dukkha is the letting go of things, their cessation, their disappearance. And soon the message will be very clear to you. The path to enlightenment will be open. You know, once the path is open, there we go, it's the Buddha calling. Once the path is open, then it's only a matter of time before you follow it. Once enlightenment calls you up on the mobile phone, you have to answer it. You have to. So that's insight arising. And that's how you become enlightened. So, it will happen sooner or later. So happy meditating. Give you lots of information here. Lots of brainwashing. So hopefully, I don't know, hopefully, I know it's going to happen, because I remember some of the things which come up into my mind. Where did that come from? And I actually traced it back, came from Ajahn Chah. He mentioned something years ago, I completely forgot about it, and when it was needed, then it came up. Just like what I've been saying now, much of all this, you may not even remember, you go home to get it all. You think. It's in there. And once it's in there, it will come out when it's needed. The requisites for enlightenment. There we go. Okay, so there you go. The Dhamma is calling you up. Answer the phone and receive the message. You're now a streamer. Okay, that's enough for now. So I hope you've enjoyed the retreat. There's still some hours to go. We're supposed to be cleaning up, and we're supposed to be having photographs, we're supposed to be doing this, and supposed to be doing that. Those who have to leave early, you leave early. Those who leave late, you leave late. We're going to carry on till about 3 o'clock for those who can stay till 3 o'clock. And at 3 o'clock, at 2 o'clock, if you're here, please at 2 o'clock, come in here and everybody meditate in here. And we do like half an hour ordinary meditation, and then about 2:30 we do a metta meditation. And we finish off just before 3 o'clock, and at 3 o'clock we give the final blessing so everyone can go back home nice and peacefully. If you can wait that long. If you can't wait that long, it doesn't matter. You've got enough oomph inside you already. You're not missing out on anything. So just enjoy your journey back home. And you know this retreat center is here, and so now you know it's a comfortable retreat center. You don't need to be afraid of coming on retreats. It's nice and gentle and peaceful. You know how it works. So that you can come back again whenever you wish. So I wish you all happy meditation. Those of you who have to go home before lunch or after lunch, please have a nice journey back, and I'll see you around. So I travel around Australia and Southeast Asia. I'm sure I'll see you there somewhere. Enjoy your retreats, enjoy your meditation, and may you all become enlightened as soon as possible, ASAP. Very good. Now, I think there was supposed to be, people did ask for an official photograph, first of all. Is that right? Okay. So yes. So, I think the nicest place is in front of the stupa. So, if those of you really, really have to go to the toilet, go quick and get it over and done with. Otherwise, you won't make it into the photograph. Everyone else, we can assemble outside in front of the stupa. So, don't go doing your jobs and business yet, because otherwise we'll have to wait for you. You won't get in the photo. So, we can do the photo first of all, then we can do all our jobs.